Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Tuesday, November 29th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Allie Martin.
And I'm Sarah Lang.
LaVielle Campbell has been an artist for as long as she can remember. At age 5, she would get her work done in school so she could go outside and paint a brick wall with water. At 7, she was collecting seed beads for small projects. Art got her through childhood illnesses and, in adulthood, 2 bouts with cancer. "It saved my life," she says, "because I always had art to fall back on, so whenever something happened, I wouldn't get depressed. I would have something to work on." The pandemic and her retirement from a career as a legal secretary brought her something she'd never had before: time. The result was an explosion of creativity and 6 exhibitions, one of which I visited at the Bakersfield Museum of Art in Southern California. "Of Rope and Chain Her Bones Are Made" is a collection of works by 9 women celebrating the handiwork that underlies the often invisible work associated with womanhood. The exhibit highlights the dichotomy of strength and femininity and is full of whimsy. Ropes dangling from a wall that turn out to be cast bronze, playful hanging sculptures made from salvaged plastics, ceramic beads shaped like little pieces of bone strung together to make a curtain. "All expression is valuable," says Ms. Campbell, whose pieces include an improvised black and white quilt and a number of ceramic sculptures. Black-eyed peas appear in all of her exhibitions, a triumphant nod to the sting of racism she felt in graduate school. Ms. Campbell had created an altar as a final art project, honoring her grandmother and great-grandmother who were enslaved. The teacher got angry about the tribute, which included foods specific to Black culture, and humiliated Ms. Campbell in front of the class. "The peas," she says, "are a scar from those days and a satisfying reminder of her success." Invariably, that success uplifts women. "I want to represent women who are always in the picture but never get credit for it," she says. Now, today's stories. Our first story, the big question: if most of the trading in cryptocurrencies is high-risk speculation and they will require traditional regulation anyway, does the world really need such alternative money?
The collapse of a key company in an industry that's creating a new kind of money has put an odd twist on an age-old question. Why do bad people happen to good things? The latest character in this financial saga appears to be Sam Bankman-Fried, founder of FTX, which served as an exchange for a digital form of money called cryptocurrency. On November 11th, FTX collapsed in spectacular fashion, declaring bankruptcy after 10 tumultuous days of revelations that the company was using customers' money to buy assets of a sister company. Since FTX is the world's number 2 exchange for cryptocurrencies, its failure has stunned the crypto world the way that the failure of the NASDAQ exchange could cause stock investors to panic. Already on Monday, lender BlockFi filed for bankruptcy, and analysts say other dominoes could fall in the crypto world, which is already reeling from a string of bankruptcies this year. FTX's collapse has also shaken confidence in the technology and left its supporters red-faced, including celebrity athletes such as football's Tom Brady and basketball's Steph Curry. And yet, in the midst of what's become known as the crypto winter, many enthusiasts remain steadfast in their confidence that the technology will transform the way people pay each other. This story was reported by Lauren Belsey for The Monitor.
Preventing birds from colliding with buildings is about more than reducing avian deaths. Conservationists see it as part of a larger imperative to reduce the human impact on the natural world.
Annette Prince moves briskly in the pre-dawn light, scanning the base of each building she passes in her sector of downtown Chicago. She spots a warbler sitting on the concrete, upright but dazed. She traps it with a flick of her net, It probably hit one of the upper floors, says Miss Prince, a volunteer bird collision monitor. It's a little wobbly. She'll take it to the rehab center. The warbler is fortunate. In the contest between birds and cities, cities are winning. Scientists estimate that collisions with buildings kill as many as 1 billion birds a year in the United States. The light from ever-expanding cities is disrupting the movement of creatures that evolved to migrate in the dark. And the modern architectural penchant for glass has proved deadly. Lights out programs, in which owners and managers agree to switch off exterior lights during peak migration times, has spread to 45 U.S. cities. Some architects and developers are using specially treated glass that birds can see. Grassroots activists are asking homeowners to consider their own windows as well. The issue is bigger than birds, conservationists say. It's a proxy for a much bigger problem of our stewardship of the planet, says Andrew Farnsworth, an ornithologist with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The fact that architects and builders are using bird-friendly technology, that is a positive, he says. But it's not happening as fast as it needs to be. The story was reported by Richard Mertens in Chicago for The Monitor.
Pakistan has been ruled either directly or indirectly by the army for its entire 75 years of existence. Now both hope and skepticism abound, as Pakistanis consider a future without a politicking military.
General Qamar Javed Bajwa retired today after 6 years in office in a particularly tumultuous year for Pakistani politics. In his final speech as head of Pakistan's powerful military, the beleaguered army chief publicly called for an end to the institution's political meddling. A future in which the army confines itself to its constitutional role is difficult to imagine. Over the past 7 decades, when generals haven't been ruling Pakistan directly, they have exerted their influence through a series of puppet politicians whom they nurture and later discard. So constant has been their hegemony that they are euphemistically referred to as the country's establishment. It is because of this history that, for all the hope elicited by General Bajwa's address, there are many in Pakistan who remain unconvinced about its sincerity. Others say the civilian government is simply too weak to stand alone and the cycle of military involvement too deeply entrenched to break. Former Foreign Minister Sartaj Aziz, who was part of the government deposed in the military coup of 1999, is more optimistic. General Bajwa's farewell speech was bold, candid, and open, he says. I think they have learned that meddling only makes them controversial and are committed to remain apolitical if allowed to do so. This story was reported by Hassan Ali in Islamabad for The Monitor.
Jerusalem, sacred to the world's major religions, is a place that millions of people think they know. A veteran Middle East correspondent paints a fuller picture of the old city as a vibrant mix of cultures, languages, and religious practices.
For nearly 3 decades, British journalist and broadcaster Matthew Teller has written articles and produced documentaries from across the Arab world, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. In Nine Quarters of Jerusalem, a new biography of the old city, he turns to a city known across the world but understood by few, Jerusalem. Mr. Teller recently spoke with The Monitor on why he believes Jerusalem's inhabitants are overlooked, and how the old city's diverse cultures, sects, languages, and traditions defy its division into quarters. He explains that visitors often focus on religious experiences at the expense of seeing the humanity of the people who live there. Tourists visit to tick boxes, pray at this church, visit this mosque, or kiss the Western Wall, he says. I was observing people in the midst of this culmination of their spirituality, treating the people of the old city as obstacles between them and these holy places, he says. It didn't seem right to me. It didn't seem respectful. This Q&A was conducted by Taylor Luck for The Monitor.
Nature is patient and persuasive, and can turn a burdensome chore into an occasion for celebration.
I was surrounded by geraniums the way a gazelle is surrounded by lions. Having already watered David and Jody's plants for more than half an hour, I was beginning to think the sun would set before I finished. David and Jody had opened their home to us when they visited family back east last winter. All they asked was that we water the plants. Then we opened Jody's email with instructions. There were 20 geraniums, at least, maybe just on the first floor, but also moth orchids, vining and split-leaf philodendrons, 5 kinds of lily, fan palms, prayer plants, snake plants, a giant ficus, and a dragon tree. We'd spent 50 minutes on task when I carted the watering cans upstairs. I entered the main bedroom. The window was full of afternoon light, the sunbeams a river cascading down on a floor covered with plants that were fecund and flourishing. As quickly as light falls on leaves, my attitude changed. I was part of a living, breathing place. Every blossom and leaf made me smile. I was surrounded by plants the way a river stone is surrounded by water. This piece was written by Noah Davis for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on how Taiwan differs from China after pandemic missteps. Last weekend, when protesters across China called on Communist Party leader Xi Jinping to step down over his strict zero COVID policies, just 100 miles away in Taiwan, the leader of the island nation's ruling party did just that. President Tsai Ing-wen resigned as head of the Democratic Progressive Party following the party's major defeat in local elections. "We humbly accept the decision of the people of Taiwan," she stated. One key reason for the party's defeat in the city and county races was Ms. Tsai's fumbled response to a surge in COVID-19 cases earlier this year. In China, the official response to public anger over COVID-19 policies, especially citywide lockdowns, has been a severe police crackdown. In sharp contrast, similar discontent in Taiwan has been peacefully channeled through a thriving democracy. Ms. Tsai's reaction to her party's loss shows a key quality rarely evoked in a dictatorship. Just after her election in 2016, her first instruction to her party was to be humble and be more humble. Elected leaders, unlike in China, must accept either the admiration or the admonishment of voters. The protesters in China have said as much. That's a wrap for the news. You can find full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. For more Monitor audio, including our serial podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. Don't miss tomorrow's trip with our Stephanie Haynes to a Florida community that challenged Hurricane Ian and won. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how when disheartening situations arise, we can turn to God for a spiritual view of reality that comforts, uplifts, and brings joy and progress. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Tim Malone, and Sarah Lang.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2022.